From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As untold numbers of Timorese lie dead throughout the country, with hundreds of thousands of people forced from their homes there, we'll take a look at a controversy that's raging in legislatures around the world. Why the military support for the Indonesian regime? Today we'll go to Britain, where legislators are fighting over the sale of Hawk fighter planes to the regime. Then, two Westerners are sentenced to 7 and 17 years hard labor in Burma. We'll find out why. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Psychological.
Tanks, trucks, and armored personnel carriers rumbled off warships in Dili today as international forces took control of East Timor. Jubilant citizens cheered the peacekeepers and mocked the demoralized Indonesian troops. Australian soldiers took over warehouses pillaged by militia gangs and their Indonesian army backers, while other troops arrested gang members and stripped them of machetes and homemade guns. In Dili, hundreds of refugees streamed out of the hills where they'd sought refuge, returning to watch the UN-mandated force, which first began arriving yesterday, take control of the burned-out capital after the militia's three-week campaign of terror. Indare, site of a large refugee camp of tens of thousands of Timorese 6 miles south of Dili, people burst into tears of joy as international soldiers in full battle gear and a group of United Nations officials drove up in a convoy of UN vehicles. Viva Timor-Leste, chanted the crowd. Long live East Timor. Between 190,000 and 300,000 people fled into hiding in the mountains. High-rise apartment buildings were knocked off foundations in Taiwan today, and roads buckled into waves of asphalt when a powerful earthquake struck Taiwan, killing more than 1,500 people and destroying hundreds of homes. With a preliminary magnitude of 7.6, the quake's the strongest hit Taiwan in a decade, and was about the same strength as the devastating tremor that killed more than 15,000 people in Turkey last month. Most of the structures that collapsed were new high-rises. Here in this country, Congress and the White House are battling over President Clinton's clemency offer to jailed Puerto Rican activists. Indiana Republican Dan Burton is opening hearings into the clemency case today. A spokesperson for the House Government Reform Committee says a videotape will be presented that shows two of the Puerto Rican activists President Clinton freed from prison. They say it will show them making bombs. Republicans also contend the clemency offer is politically motivated to help First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton's expected U.S. Senate campaign in New York. Puerto Rican activists around the country say that the militants who are released from jail have been misrepresented, and that their resistance originally to the clemency offer was over issues of constitutional rights, like being allowed to associate with other Puerto Rican activists when they left prison. Also their concern, leaving others in prison behind. This news from Texas. After a second white supremacist was convicted of dragging a black man to his death, relatives of the victim applauded the verdict and looked toward the penalty phase. Family members of James Byrd Jr. hugged law enforcement officers outside the courtroom following the guilty verdict against Lawrence Brewer. He faces a sentence of life in prison or death. Brewer is 32 years old. He showed no emotion yesterday as a jury of 11 whites and one Latino found him guilty of capital murder in the torture slaying of James Byrd in Jasper last summer. The jury returned immediately to begin hearing testimony on Brewer's punishment. The hearing is to resume today as they decide whether he should get the death penalty. A veteran FBI agent has been picked to head the New Jersey State Police, an embattled 2,700-member force accused of targeting minority drivers for traffic stops and discriminating against its own officers. New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman announced her choice of Carson Dunbar Jr. yesterday. His nomination will be considered by New Jersey lawmakers next week. And this news from Paducah, Kentucky. At times, it sounded as if Stephen King had written some of the testimony during a U.S. Senate field hearing into allegations of wrongdoing at a federally owned uranium processing plant. tales of radioactive salt on lunch tables, burying truckloads of uranium shavings as they ignited and burned, and tossing contaminated barrels into ponds emerged from the hearings yesterday. The U.S. Department of Energy owns the plant and oversees a costly environmental cleanup of the site. The agency is investigating why workers were unwittingly exposed to plutonium and other highly toxic and radioactive substances, and whether contractors who operated the plant covered it up. And finally, a Cambodian opposition leader urged foreign powers to pressure Prime Minister Hun Sen into accepting a UN-administered genocide tribunal for Khmer Rouge guerrilla leaders. In a statement timed to coincide with Hun Sen's speech at the UN General Assembly, outspoken opposition leader Sam Rainsy said only intense political pressure will alter his government's insistence that the Khmer Rouge be tried in a Cambodian court. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As international peacekeepers move into East Timor today, we will find more and more about what happened in the country, particularly the countryside. There have been stories that have leaked from places like Swai, south of Dili, where militia backed by the Indonesian regime went into a church compound, threw grenades, and sprayed more than 100 women and children with gunfire, also cutting down each priest who came out to protect them. Just one story among hundreds of thousands of others. As these stories come out of East Timor, and not just over the last days, but over the last decades of the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, there's a controversy that's raging in parliaments around the world, and that is why they supported the Indonesian regime. Today we're going to Britain to find out about the fight that is taking place over the British government's sale of Hawk fighter planes to the Indonesian regime. We're joined right now by Jeremy Corbyn, who is a British parliamentarian. The Labour Party also was a UN-accredited observer of the Timor referendum. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us what this controversy is about in Britain?
Britain has had a disgraceful record in relation to Indonesia and a very close relationship with the Indonesian military. Indonesian officers have been trained at British officer training schools. We've supplied Hawk aircraft to them over a long period. We've supplied armoured personnel carriers. We've supplied very sensitive communications equipment for the Indonesian army. And indeed, we've supplied light weaponry and ammunition as well. It is appalling. 2 years ago, when the current Labour government was elected, the officers of the Parliamentary Human Rights Group went in a delegation, and I was one of them, to see the Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, and request that we stop all arms sales immediately to Indonesia. Unfortunately, he refused to do that, and most of the arms that were on order were subsequently delivered. The feeling is very strong in Britain, and indeed, a group of women who broke into the British aerospace factory where the Hawk aircraft were manufactured managed to damage a number of these aircraft, were then put on trial in court for criminal damage and indeed released by a jury on the grounds that they did it out of conscience to stop them being exported to Indonesia. The situation is that there's very strong feelings in this country of support for the Timorese people, and frankly, appalled at the way the Indonesian army has behaved. I was there for the referendum along with many other UN observers. We witnessed the intimidation and the violence that went on towards people who were voting for their own independence. And frankly, when I came away, I was just disgusted that the rest of the world has allowed this to happen by arming this ghastly military machine of Indonesia's.
We're talking to Jeremy Corbyn, Labour member of the British Parliament, and that's the operative word there, Mr. Corbyn, Labour member. You are a member of the ruling party. This is your government that's been funding or supporting with these weapons the Indonesian regime.
Yes, and it makes me very, very angry, as indeed it makes many other people angry. This evening in London we have a public meeting in which John Pilger and myself and others will be speaking. John Pilger, very well-known Australian journalist who's been resident in Britain for a long time, has made very good films about Timor, and we will be demanding an end to all arms sales to Indonesia and pointing out what's happened since they went on. Last week we had a conference in Britain of the arms exporting companies, and they invited representatives from all over the world, including people from 45 countries that are on the Amnesty list of human rights abusers. Indonesia eventually didn't come, although that was only at the last minute. They were due to be attending up until then. And indeed, there's also a story in today's British newspapers that New Zealand, which is a party to the UN peace operation, is still training Indonesian army officers. The world has got to wake up to Indonesia's illegal invasion of East Timor in 1975. A quarter of the population have died since that invasion took place, and the militia are not a part of a civil war. It isn't a civil war in Timor. It is a war by an occupying power using militia to attack the Timorese people, kill them or drive them out and settle others in there that they can then take up on the riches that exist under Timor, particularly the oil in the sea around it.
Jeremy Corbyn, we're also joined by Kieran O'Reilly, who is a longtime peace activist in Britain, served time in a U.S. prison for hammering on a B-52 bomber shortly before the Gulf War, most recently facing time in Britain for protesting British aerospace and their Hawk fighter planes used in Indonesia and Timor. Kieran O'Reilly, explain why it is you face a possible 2 years in a British jail.
Well, I think if you look at the genealogy of this genocide, you have to realize, obviously, the militia is a creation of the Indonesian military, and the Indonesian military are a creation of British and American and Australian complicity. And one of the people who've corporations that have profited mostly here in Britain have been British Aerospace by selling the high-tech Hawk fighter aircraft to this genocidal regime. And as Mr. Corbyn said before, a Liverpool jury, when they had the facts put before them in 96 by four women who did £1.5 million worth of disarmament to a Hawk already painted in Indonesian Air Force colours about to leave Britain, found them not guilty, and intimately said that if there's any crime, it's in selling a high-tech weapon system to a genocidal regime, it's not in disarming it. As soon as those women were released after 6 months on remand, they were hit with civil injunctions by British Aerospace, which actually restricted their ability to speak freely about the issues. British Aerospace then hit nine other activists in Britain, including myself, with similar injunctions, leaving us with huge legal bills, £100,000 in my case. These injunctions are very broad. One man, Chris Kohler, says 6 months in prison for merely writing a leaflet encouraging a non-violent blockade of British Aerospace. So they're quite expansive and quite restricting even on the ability to speak truth to power.
And your most recent action, Kieran?
Well, I've been living here in Liverpool since that trial with Timorese exiles, young men who occupied embassies in Jakarta, got asylum in Portugal, and moved to Britain to confront the weapon systems that are killing their people. So repetitively, we've gone back to BAE and trespass and prayed, symbolic actions like burying coffins near the runway. And with these young men, many who've been tortured in Indonesian jails in East Timor, been arrested with them and done a bit of time over here in England. I'm also from Australia originally, where we've done actions like initiate the sanctuary movement, the Australian Labor Party tried to deport 1,200 East Timorese to Portugal while arguing the oil wasn't Portuguese. The people were, apparently. So we've attempted to stand up against that, and there's a huge sanctuary movement similar to what existed in the US in the 80s in relation to Central America. We've done actions at mining companies that are illegally stealing the oil from the Timor Sea, and also actions against the military training of Capacis in Australia. So we've attempted over the years, it's been a 23-year genocide, and until recently it was fairly secretive. People like John Pilger and Noam Chomsky were pretty much lone voices in trying to raise these high crimes. So the situation has kind of changed rapidly in the last few months, I guess.
You know, when I was deported from Indonesia a few weeks ago and got to see the military blacklist of more than 1,000 names, among the names on it was John Pilger, who is well-known journalist, documentarian, did the superb film on Timor called Death of a Nation that everyone should see. Both you, Kieran, and Jeremy Corbyn, British parliamentarian, have mentioned him. I'm thinking about the segment of the film, Jeremy Corbyn, where he is confronting the Home Secretary about the sale of weapons. He's justifying it, and then John Pilger says to him, Mr. Home Secretary, sir, you are a vegetarian, aren't you? And he said, that's right. And he said, why? And he said, because I don't believe in killing living things. Jeremy Corbyn, this is an issue that has not taken center stage in Britain until now. Where do you think it will go?
I think that it will be a big issue at next week's Labour Party conference. It's the annual conference of the Labour Party in Bournemouth. There will be fringe meetings in which the issue will be raised, and there are demonstrations and rallies going on all the time all over the country about it. And when Parliament resumes in about a month's time, it will come up there. In the meantime, we are sending delegations into the Defence Ministry and the Foreign Office to demand a cessation of all arms sales rather than a suspension of those arms sales. And as well as the UN policing operation force that's gone in at the moment, I do think that humanitarian aid is equally important, because whilst one has to obviously control the militia, disarm them and so on, there is a crying need for food and medical aid, and above all improvements in public health and hygiene in Timor. The death rate from preventable causes is huge at the present time, and so there's a massive need there. Indonesia occupied, committed genocide against its people, attempted to rob all its natural resources, has now left the country bereft of everything. We have to move in and help as best we can, but above all recognise that the Timorese people at last had an opportunity to vote in the referendum at the end of August. They made their decisions very, very clearly known. We must not allow an illegal occupation to go on. If anything annoys me, it's the way that the world's media sort of still rather gently treat Indonesia as though it has some reasonable locus in the discussions about Timor. It does not. It's an illegal occupying power on behalf of the wealthy and the powerful, and the world's arms industries have made a great deal of money out of this.
So will the Parliament vote to cut off all weapons? Will they vote for humanitarian aid?
At the moment, the government has suspended the delivery of weapons. I hope there will be a decision to cancel all those weapons deliveries, although there's nothing guaranteed about that at the present time. Some aid is promised to go. I don't think there's anything like enough being pledged at the present time. There has to be a very big increase in it, and those are the things we'll be arguing for. I can't predict what's going to happen. What I do know is there's a huge head of steam at last building up on the situation in Timor. Over the past few years, those people that have been campaigning on Timor have felt that it's a bit of a voice in the wilderness. I mean, John Pilger's excellent films have done a great deal to arouse public consciousness. And indeed, in my own community, I've just been around visiting people this morning, and they've all been stopping me and asking me what it was like in Timor and what they can do to try to stop all weapons deliveries. Maybe this is going to be the turning point in the attitude towards the sale of arms around the world. Britain is, after the United States, I think, the third or fourth biggest arms exporter in the world.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn, I want to thank you for being with us. I know you have to leave. Member of British Parliament of the ruling party, of the Labour Party, just returned from East Timor, where he was one of the UN-accredited observers in the historic August 30th referendum, where the Timorese voted overwhelmingly for independence. We will stay with Kieran O'Reilly, longtime peace activist in Britain, facing 2 years possible jail sentence now for involvement in protests against British Aerospace. And we'll be joined by Alan Nairn, who's been bringing us daily reports on East Timor. He's just been deported from East Timor through Indonesia and is now in Singapore. After that, we'll talk about another story that is connected to Britain. It is two activists from Britain who have been sentenced to 7 and 17 years hard labor in Burma for their protests of the regime. Then we're going to hear from the second part of an interview with the Methodist minister, the Methodist bishop of Argentina, about Pinochet's years. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our daily reports on East Timor, the UN-led peacekeepers in East Timor right now, actually led by the Australian Army as they move into Dili, the capital. Tens of thousands of people in Dare, just outside of East Timor, altogether hundreds of thousands of Timorese forced out of their homes. Close to 200,000, perhaps 250,000 in West Timor, which is a part of Indonesia now, forced there and now being held in militia-run, Indonesian regime-run camps where they're being terrorized. And the count on the number of deaths in Timor just over the last few weeks has not been totaled, as the country has not even been fully now open to the outside world. Our guest, Kieran O'Reilly, longtime peace activist in Britain, and journalist Alan Nairn, speaking to us from Singapore, just deported from Indonesia. Alan, you've long been working on cutting off military sales and the military relationship between from the United States to the Indonesian regime. Your response to hearing about the controversy that's raging right now in Britain, it's a lot quieter in the halls of Congress in the United States.
Well, yeah, I don't know what's been happening in Congress in the U.S. Recently, but for years it's been like pulling teeth to get first the Bush administration and then the Clinton administration to agree to any weapons or training cutbacks. Grassroots pressure has achieved cutbacks, but it's been very difficult. In the U.S. Congress, though, support has been growing, both from Republicans and Democrats. And now they are considering legislation that would try to do some kind of thorough cutoff. But one thing for the public to be alert to is that unless Clinton and Albright and the other key figures in the administration truly want to cut off a regime, there are innumerable ways that they can get around an announced cutoff, or even get around very tough legislation. For example, the most recent new training program for the Indonesian military, the riot control program, which was given to General Wiranto just after the militia terror and the attacks and repression in Aceh reached its peak this summer. This program is not done through the Pentagon. It's done through the Justice Department and, in part, the State Department. So even though it goes to the Indonesian military, specifically to the police, which report to Wiranto in his capacity as defense minister, and also specifically to BRIMOB, the anti-riot unit of the police, which is a commando force that was directly involved in the Likisa church massacre of April, and which was directly involved in the recent militia terror in Timor. Brimob people would go house to house deporting Timorese. They were involved on the on an attack on the the attack and burning of a convent 2 weeks ago. This Brimob force was recently trained by the U.S., but that was under the auspices of justice and state. So even if you have an announced cutoff or a bill that is framed towards, say, settling Pentagon to Indonesian Army relations, a program like that would get around the restriction. There are also many other connections between the CIA and the Indonesian military, between local police forces of the U.S. and the Indonesian military. There are obscure programs involving agencies like the Export-Import Bank. There are just all sorts of ways in which the U.S. executive branch, if it wants to, can prop up the Indonesian military. So people will have to be very vigilant to insist on a total cutoff. And, of course, it goes without saying that if Clinton and Albright and the other Cohen and the other leaders truly want to cut off the regime, they can do it. I'm confident that you wouldn't find any backdoor military programs by which the U.S. is, say, aiding Cuba or aiding Libya or aiding other regimes that they truly want to not back militarily. But, of course, the TNI Opry is a longtime client of Washington, and they're doing this cutoff only under extreme public and congressional duress. So you really have to watch them like a hawk to make sure it's real.
Well, Alan, we're going to be addressing just what the legislation is in the United States in the coming days. The Feingold bill, that's Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin, calling for a total cutoff of military weapons that would include those weapons in the pipeline right now. Even as President Clinton in Auckland, New Zealand, at the APEC summit talked about cutting off military weapon sales to Indonesia, looks as if those already sold that had not yet made it there, in fact, are headed there. We'll also be talking about the bill in the House, Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island, Frank Wolf of Virginia, and others who are sponsoring this bill, again, to cut off military weapon sales, military relationship, and IMF World Bank loans. But I want to give Kieran O'Reilly the last word. Kieran, we hear a lot about globalization at the top and corporate power amassing around the world. Do you feel that this is a turning point as Plowshares activists in Britain work with these activists in Australia and longtime East Timor activists in the United States in dealing with the issue of arms cutoffs and stopping the support of regimes like Indonesia?
Well, just to comment on something earlier about Alan Clark and saying, you know, being loving animals and
the Home Secretary,
human beings, you know, some of the big social movements here in England at the moment are basically the environment and animal liberation. And on the negative side, I think people have given up on human liberation, and I think that's the essential question. But when you look at the compound where 50 UN staff disobeyed the UN, because to save 1,000 lives at the risk of their own, I think there's also great symbols of hope like that as well. And we have to globalize our resistance and maintain our nonviolent discipline. And there's been great acts of heroism by the Timorese people themselves over 23 years, and recently by even, you know, civilian police, UN staff, human rights activists. So I think we've experienced a great tragedy in the last few weeks, but also great hope. And the cynicism of government, there were four Hawk fighters painted in Indonesian Air Force colors here 10 days ago. 2 days later, there was only one. 2 days after that, the British government announces, you know, a moral suspension of arms sales. So, if, you know, whether government tipped off the corporation and got them moving is a question. Those three planes are now stranded in Thailand because one of the pilots is sick, but the government still won't bring them back. So I think it's up to people to take non-violent direct action. Hopefully those in power will have to follow. And if we predicted this suspension of arms sales last year, the threat of the World Bank not funding this dictatorship, you know, we thought we'd be dreaming last year, but this is reality at the moment. And we still have to be very cautious the Timorese people have suffered and died for independence, not to become a UN colony. So I think we have to be still cautious about the agendas of Britain, America, and Australia and East Timor.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Kieran O'Reilly and Alan Nairn, for being with us. Kieran O'Reilly, longtime peace activist in Britain. Alan Nairn, journalist deported from Indonesia and East Timor, right now in Singapore. And we're going to continue on this issue of challenging the powers in terms of the issue of human rights. Burma has sentenced a second young Briton in 2 weeks for protesting against the military government, drawing the concern of family members and diplomats and further attention to the political repression in Burma. These two people, who face 7 and 17 years hard labor for their protests, will join hundreds of right now in the insane jail in Rangoon, the capital of Burma. 800 political prisoners have been languishing. Rachel Goldwyn is 28 years old, a human rights campaigner, given 7 years of hard labor after chaining herself to a lamppost and singing songs at a marketplace in the capital, found guilty of, quote, undermining peace, security, and stability with her one-person protests, which had drawn a crowd of several hundred people. Earlier this month, James Maudsley, who is 26, was sentenced to 17 years in prison after being convicted of entering Burma illegally, shouting revolutionary slogans, and carrying pro-democracy leaflets. We're joined on the phone right now by Dr. Charmaine Goldwyn, who is Rachel's mother. She's a general practitioner in London and is heading to Burma, hopefully, to see her daughter this weekend. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Goldwyn.
Hello.
Well, can you tell us about Rachel, what happened, what the trial was about?
Well, yes, I think you've described it very well. I mean, we actually didn't know that Rachel had gone to Burma because we would have tried to stop it, knowing the regime there. We thought she'd gone on holiday to Germany. And so the first we heard was about 2 weeks ago when the Foreign Office rang. And I thought, my goodness, she's had an accident in Germany. But in fact, no, they said she'd been arrested in Burma, which was very shocking indeed, especially as we just heard about James Maudsley's sentence. She had been singing this song, a democracy-type song, and as she had planned it, she had planned to do this at this time.
Why did she get interested in Burma?
Well, in 1997, she and a friend set off around the world, as they do, and she got as far as Thailand when somebody sitting in the next door table in a cafe, hearing her speak English, said, you know, I'm working for a charity in the refugee camps and we're desperately short of help teaching English to people who've been off sick. And she and her friend, Bob, went there and they actually taught English in this camp to the teachers and to the students, the young people, and helped build a school and all sorts of things like that for about 9 months. And while she was there, and we went out there too and visited her, she heard many stories of horrible things that had happened to the people over the border in Burma, you know, fighting, and people had been raped and tortured and killed, and people had been killed in front of their loved ones. And I don't think she herself ever saw so many people die as that she did on that camp, because there was malaria and all that there. And I think that gradually sort of made her feel very strongly inside herself that she wanted to do something about it. She got a very strong conviction that she needed to do something. She's a girl full of compassion, full of care for other people. All her life she's been compassionate, and always, right from the smallest insect to the, you know, anything, she's always been very caring. And this plan she gradually made, and this is what she did, and this is the horrific punishment she has received for it.
Dr. Goldwyn, did you get to go to the trial?
No, we are put in for our visas the day we found she was arrested. And yesterday we went to see the Burmese ambassador, who is a very, very decent man, very kind, but do you know, the Burmese ambassador in Britain. And he gave us our visas, so we're going out as soon as we can. And hopefully we'll be there for the appeal.
I understand in her trial that the prosecution called 11 witnesses, including police officers, local government officials, the proprietor of the guest house where she was staying, but no witnesses on her own behalf except for her.
Well, I suppose that's because nobody would be brave enough to stand up. I mean, how, you know, they would also have a prison sentence to stand up for her, would they? I mean, you wouldn't expect that, really. And it would, you know, her lawyer would have to find somebody who would really, really be brave enough to do that.
The song she sang was called We Will Never
Forget.
Yes,
shall I read out the words?
Yes.
We're writing in blood for history, for those who died for democracy. We respect the martyrs, we salute them. There are so many dead in the streets. It's a very pretty song. And when I heard her singing it here, she learnt it in Burmese, I thought she was singing it for a charity thing they were doing. I'd no idea this is what was planned.
Well, Dr. Goldwyn, we also have with us Ben Roth, who is a spokesperson for Amnesty International, also speaking from London. Ben, can you put this in the broader context of the number of people who are serving similar or much longer sentences in Burma, the number of Burmese?
Yes, of course. Good morning. We are obviously very concerned about the case of Rachel Goldwyn and also James Maudsley. But in terms of putting it into the context, this is almost the tip of the iceberg. And the fact that they are from Western countries means that international attention has been focused on them. What we are extremely concerned about, too, is actually the plight of the Burmese within the country themselves. We know there are over sort of 1,500 political prisoners who are being held in Burmese prisons, a lot of which are prisoners of conscience, those people who have been imprisoned solely for expressing their beliefs, their religion, or daring to speak out against the regime, and who have not advocated or used any violence whatsoever. So it's a very grave situation, and we hope now that international attention will be drawn to what's happening inside the country through the unfortunate plight of James and Rachel.
Can you tell us about the insane jail in Rangoon?
We've had many reports from people who've been in prison there. It is a notorious jail in terms of prison conditions and the way people are treated. There are also various reports and allegations that torture takes place there, in particularly in sort of the interrogation stage. We are obviously extremely concerned about what happens within all Burmese jails, and insane is unfortunately just one of them.
And what are the kinds of sentences people get, and what does it mean that both Rachel and James Maudsley have gotten sentenced to many years of hard labor? What does hard labor mean for the Westerners and for the Burmese?
Well, hard labor means hard labor. It means forcibly being forced to work for the Burmese government in extremely hostile work, extremely bad conditions. People are often very malnourished and undertreated. There's often a lack of medical care. In terms of Rachel and James's case, we sincerely hope that they will be released, and we urge the British government and other international governments to put as much pressure on the Burmese government to ensure that they are released as soon as possible.
I'm looking at an account of what happened to James Maudsley, the 26-year-old sentenced to 17 years in prison after being convicted of entering Burma illegally. He'd been arrested and deported twice before in the last 2 years on charges of anti-government activity. And after last year's arrest, his family says he fainted twice during 15 hours of torture, during which he was forced to stand up with a bag over his head, beaten with bamboo sticks whenever he fell down. He spent 99 days in solitary confinement and then was ejected from the country. But that was not the case this time, as he has now been imprisoned and sentenced to 17 years.
Yes, that's right. James's case is very similar to what happens every day and routinely to political prisoners and even criminal prisoners in Burma. They're sort of subjected to severe beatings, prolonged shackling, and lack of adequate medical care. So yes, it's extremely concerning, and we strongly urge the Burmese government to release all political prisoners and to ensure that those who are in prison and who do need urgent medical care are granted immediate care and access.
Let me ask each of you this question. That is Britain's involvement with the Burmese government. What kinds of connections do they have? Do you know, Ben Roth?
Britain, as being part of the European Union, has extended its sanctions to against Burma to sort of include transit and tourist visas for members of the government's military. We put as much pressure on the British government as possible to maintain these sanctions and to be very careful and very with its links to the military government, so that no aid or investment that we provide to Burma is used to carry out these terrible human rights violations.
in the United States, Unocal has been a focus of a lot of protests, a Los Angeles-based oil giant, for its involvement in Burma. When President Clinton supported the sanctions against Burma, they were careful to talk about new investment as opposed to what was going on there already. Dr. Charmaine Goldwyn will give you the last word before you leave for Burma. First, do you plan to see your daughter, and what does she want in terms of support from people around the world?
Well, I'm sure she would agree with everything that Ben Roth said, and I would too, about other political prisoners. It's just, you know, she's raised everybody's sympathy, this young, pretty English girl, but there are many, many people languishing there who, you know, have perhaps been forgotten. But I would say, to be honest, I don't really agree with sanctions. I think we need to integrate. We need to go in there. We need to help them. I mean, I think a poor country is not going to be able to develop. I mean, I think that in Iraq, the sanctions have been disastrous, if you ask me. I don't agree with sanctions myself.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It's a conversation we will continue to have. Dr. Charmaine Goldwyn, thanks for joining us. General practitioner from London, headed to Burma to try to see her daughter, Rachel, who's been sentenced to 7 years hard labor by the Burmese government, joining more than 1,000 Burmese political prisoners. And a thank you to Ben Roth of Amnesty International. If you'd like to go to the website, see more on Burma, www.amnesty.org is the website. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Next week begins the extradition trial of General Augusto Pinochet, who's being held in Britain right now. The question is whether he will be sent to Spain to face charges, crimes against humanity. Angry supporters of Pinochet staged a noisy demonstration yesterday during an Independence Day military parade in Santiago, demanding Britain release the general. Nearly 10,000 soldiers participated in the parade, the main celebration of the 189th anniversary of Chile's independence from Spain. One of the armed vehicles was named in Pinochet's honor. Well, yesterday we brought you the first part of an interview with Bishop Federico Pugura, who is the retired bishop of the Methodist Church of Argentina and co-president of the World Council of Churches. He was bishop during the time of Pinochet's brutal dictatorship next door in Chile, when Argentina and other military dictatorships conspired with Pinochet's regime to eliminate dissidents and political opponents. Today we bring you part two of the interview.
What did it mean to stand up to the junta for you as a bishop?
It means that I would have to keep a relationship with the government, because it was the only government existing in Argentina, and at the same time, a critical relationship. We had to make pronouncements about the situation, the different moments of the development of this dictatorship. So it was a very difficult time with a lot of tensions, particularly when we want to express our resistance. We had many marches in the streets of Buenos Aires. In many cases, they were prohibited, but we went all together, and at the same time, for instance, our Nobel Prize, Perez Esquivel, was kidnapped. Then, fortunately, we could save his life, and he came out, and he stand with us in defending the rights of the people to live and to work and to defend their own interests. So that was to live day by day under the control, the eye of the military junta put on us, because we were practically the strongest resistance to their presence, and peaceful, because we do not enter into violent actions. No.
What do you think the point of the repression was?
The point of the repression was that they need to establish a new model of society, a new economical program. They had to stop the advance of the people that were asking for a real democracy, participation in the government. They wanted to establish a regime that could affirm the rights of the strong, powerful economical minority in our country, related at the same time with the transnational companies and economical powers. After the process, when we had time to investigate, we say this was a coordinated plan for all Latin America, and I would say more, for all the third world. No? And that's why I have been always reminding even the people here in the United States that our chief leaders of the military movement were prepared in the States. They were prepared in the School of the Americas in Panama. They were prepared in other military institutes to receive their preparation, even for this this process of kidnapping and torturing and killing, destroying people, dividing families, putting people against people. All that was very well programmed and planned. And that's why we believe it is not enough to end with those dictatorships. We had to end with the ideological foundation and philosophy of all this movement that took place in Latin America and in the third world, Africa, Asia, etc. And it is part of the responsibility of the American people to investigate that and to take conscience that what we call the national security ideology has been the cause of the destructions of thousands and thousands of people all over the world, and that until you destroy that ideological structure that is still within the governments of the first world nations, we will always be under the possibility of a recovery of that same time of philosophy. And speaking theologically, that is something that we as Christians should reject entirely. And that's the responsibility of the churches. In this present moment, I believe the churches, the Jewish rabbis, even people coming from an Islamic background, should try to reflect together to see what happens with this type of ideologies that have been killing so many people in the world because of love of money. And interestingly, St. Paul, in one of his letters, said that the love of money is the root of all the bad things that happen in the world. He was not Marxist, because Marx was not present at that time of history.
I know you have to leave, but specifically in Argentina today, where do you see your country? How would you describe the situation?
We are suffering now the consequences of all that process. Economically, the new model was established, very unhuman. It is killing without arms. Now it's killing by decrees. It's killing by economical measures. We are struggling for a change in the government. Our present president speaks that we are now in the first world. He speaks about the beautiful things that he has done during these last 10 years, but he has been the most obsequent, you say, servant. Yes, servant of this type of philosophy. And as one of our lawyers said, in the future we do not need more the entrance of the armies in this process, because through economical regulations you can say what people had to leave and who had to die and disappear. And this is the type of exclusion that we are living in all Latin America. And I think it is a time for the people to react, because if not, we will be just at the service of a great empire. And perhaps your government will be the head of that empire.
Thank you very much.
Bishop Federico Pavura, retired bishop of the Methodist Church of Argentina. He's currently co-president of the World Council of Churches. On September 11, 1973, 26 years ago, the Chilean coup took place, the rise of Augusto Pinochet. And tomorrow, September 23rd, is the 26th anniversary of the former Argentine President Juan Perón returning to power. Now, bringing the issue of human rights directly home, we turn to Mumia Abu-Jamal to end the program. Death row prisoner who at any day now could have a death warrant once again signed against him. On August 12th, Mumia Abu-Jamal called into Democracy Now!, and after a few minutes, a prison guard yanked the phone out of the wall. In today's commentary, Mumia Abu-Jamal reflects on what happened that day.
On Thursday, August the 12th, 1999, I finally got through on a call I'd been trying to complete all week long. To Amy Goodman, host of the acclaimed Pacifica News broadcast, Democracy Now!, aired over WBAI-FM in New York City and over the network nationally. I was frankly thrilled to get through, and as her topic was the buzz over the imminent release of 16 Puerto Rican Independentista political prisoners, it was a perfect opportunity to express solidarity for the brave and committed Puerto Rican freedom fighters who've suffered enormously in their long imprisonment at the hands of their cruel American colonizers. After speaking with relatives and loved ones of the Independentistas, Amy calmly announced to her listeners that she had a guest on the line, me, who might offer a few opinions on the controversy. It went something like this. Amy. On the line now from a state correctional institution in Pennsylvania, after considerable difficulty, is our guest, Mumia Abu-Jamal, convicted in the murder of a Philadelphia police officer, Daniel Faulkner, in 1981. In a trial that many have condemned as riddled with constitutional and other errors. Mumia, welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you, Amy. It's my pleasure to be with you at Democracy Now!, Amy. Now, Mumia, I'm sure you've heard about the controversy that we're discussing this morning, the imminent release of some 16 Puerto Rican political prisoners under certain conditions. Have you heard? Yeah, well, I did see some mention of this on the TV, and these are my thoughts on the issue. Under the Constitution, one is allegedly allowed the rights of association. For those brothers and sisters, freedom isn't really freedom, is it? First, I want to say libertad para los presos políticos de Puerto Rico. Yes, free all Puerto Rican political prisoners. Yeah, we're with that. But under the U.S. government's plan, they'll be granted a kind of half freedom. They won't be allowed to associate with each other, so their freedom of association is dead. Also, one of the other conditions that the government is placing upon them is the demand that they, quote, renounce violence, unquote. exactly the same thing that the racist government of South Africa demanded of Nelson Mandela and other imprisoned members of the African National Congress of the ANC. Well, at that moment, the phone line went dead as a guard pulled the wire from the phone jack on the wall, disconnecting me. Another guard appeared at the cell door, hollering at the top of his lungs. This call is terminated. When I demanded to know why, he replied, this order came down from the very top. I immediately called to the sergeant standing by and looking on, and said, Sergeant, where'd this order come from? He shrugged his shoulders and answered, I don't know, we just got a phone call to cut you off. The next day, the answer came in the form of a write-up, number A69958, where I was charged with a Class 1 misconduct, unauthorized use of the mail or telephone. In the write-up, the following institutional offenses are stated, and I quote, On October the 12th, 1999, at 0936 hours, Hidmet Jamal made a telephone call to a news radio station named Pacifica Radio Network's Democracy Now! Per Administrative Directive 009, News Media Relations, it states news media requests for inmate interviews by telephone shall be approved after
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Inmate Jamal did not request from the facility's manager permission to be interviewed by the news media. In addition, inmate Jamal placed a news reporter on his phone list, knowing full well that the person was a reporter. This is verified by the attached documentation. Also, per Administrative Directive 6.5.8, all communications between capital case inmates and the news media shall be conducted in accordance with DOC and institutional policies on visitation and telephone privileges. It should be noted, inmate telephone calls are privileged. As a result of inmate Jamal not requesting permission from the facility's manager to be interviewed or speak with the news media, his telephone call was terminated after 11 minutes of speaking with the news media. Unquote. This write-up was signed by a lieutenant and a captain of the guard. In order to produce this write-up, ranking staff members had to ignore their own rules. For example, Administrative Directive 009.1, which states, quote, news media are entitled to the same access to specific inmates as the general public. There should be no special arrangements made for news media interviews with specific inmates. All communications between specific inmates and the news media shall be conducted in accordance with Administrative Directive 812 and Administrative Directive 818. If an inmate wants to talk with a news media representative over the telephone, it's his responsibility to place a collect call to the reporter under guidelines set forth in 818. Unquote. There are rules, and there are rules, it seems, especially when the state deals with me. Here the DOC writes me up using a rule that no longer exists. But since when have rules gotten in the way of corrupt bureaucracies, which follow the foul winds of their political masters? Clearly, we were not working with rules. We're working with the state's exercise of its political power to censor a captive who they once again have acted to silence. But like before, it ain't working. I thank Amy and her fervent, politically adept listeners at Democracy Now! For that great opportunity to show solidarity to the Puerto Rican independentistas. You keep on listening, I'll keep on rapping. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Donna Neiman. Thanks to Jeremy Scahill, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.